loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Republicans spent all day yesterday scrambling to round up the votes to pass the much-anticipated health care law to replace the Affordable Health Care Act, the one that they're introducing. According to the CBO report, as many as 28 million people might lose their insurance. But many Republicans oppose the bill on the grounds that it is not cruel enough. Today, we spend the full hour taking an in-depth look at what is in this bill. Is it truly a matter of life and death, of health care for tens of millions of people? We are joined from Baltimore, Maryland, by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She is the co-director of Popular Resistance, as well as a pediatrician and advocate for a single-payer health care system. We are also joined from Los Angeles by Preston Wood. He is a registered nurse case manager at the University of Southern California Keck Hospital. And we are joined by Tim Robinson. He is the CEO of Addiction Recovery Care in Kentucky. Welcome, Margaret, Preston, and Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be with you.
Margaret, let's start with you. We have a lot of ground to cover, but try to summarize this bill, if you would. I know you are a strong critic of the Affordable Care Act, the so-called Obamacare, because it didn't go far enough in terms of providing universal and affordable health care. But what's the bottom line when it comes to the practical effects of the Republican bill, the American Health Care Act? What will its impact be on society, on people?
Sure, thank you. So a few basic things about the American Health Care Act is, first off, it would roll back all the taxes in the Affordable Care Act, which is a huge tax cut for the wealthy. It would also get rid of the current subsidies that people can receive to buy health insurance on the exchanges and replace those with tax credits that are based on age rather than on income. And those tax credits would also go to people with higher incomes than currently receive subsidies right now. It would also cut, the tax cuts would be a $350 billion cut to Medicare over 10 years. So that's going to put greater strain on our Medicare system. And then they're also taking away funding for Medicaid, which is going to undermine that system as well. So generally what we're going to see is that our public insurances that people rely on, our public safety net, Medicare and Medicaid, are going to be weakened. The wealthy are going to have more income, and the burden of paying for health care, which is already too high of a burden on people of lower incomes, is going to increase. And private insurance is going to become possibly even skimpier than it is right now. People will face high out-of-pocket costs and restricted networks that will keep them from being able to get care even when they have health insurance.
Thank you. That was Dr. Margaret Flowers. We're also joined by Tim Anderson. He is the CEO of Addiction Recovery Care in Kentucky. Tim, where are you in Kentucky?
We're in the eastern part of the state, one of the most rural areas. We have 13 treatment centers in eastern and central Kentucky, and we do both residential and outpatient drug and alcohol treatment.
Addiction is a big deal in Kentucky. I mean, it's a big deal everywhere. It's a big deal for every family that has to suffer with addiction. But talk about the dimension of the crisis in Kentucky.
Well, you know, Kentucky and West Virginia go back and forth as the worst states in terms of opioid drug overdoses, and we're either one or two, depending on what year. And so it's a crisis in central Appalachia. A lot of poverty here. Poverty is a big driver of addiction, and a lot of coal mines shut down in central Appalachia, and that's caused more unemployment, and unemployment increased poverty levels. And so it's a crisis here in central Appalachia when it comes to drug overdoses, especially with pain pills and opiates, but now more and more even heroin is coming into rural parts of West Virginia and Kentucky.
Kentucky voted for Donald Trump, Tim, and Donald Trump was just there calling at a rally. He called Obamacare a disaster, but a large number of Kentuckians are now receiving health care because of expanded Medicaid. Talk about it from your point of view as someone and your organization providing services. Was Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, a disaster for people in Kentucky?
Well, it's for people who are middle class, people that ended up on the Obamacare exchanges. From our perspective, from drug and alcohol treatment, is those folks, it's hard for them to access treatment because really high deductibles, really high co-pays. So for those folks, there's not a lot of coverage. So for that group, for the middle class, it's been a disaster. For the Medicaid population, it's a different story. We have been able, starting in 2015, for the first time ever, to take Medicaid for drug and alcohol treatment, especially residential treatment, which is most effective. We've treated over 1,000 Medicaid patients since January of 2015. And so that part of the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid expansion, has really increased access to treatment in eastern and central Kentucky, and Kentucky's kind of leading the way in providing access to treatment.
So before I bring Preston Wood into the discussion then, so for the big part of the very poor people in Kentucky, and there's a lot of poor people in Kentucky, a lot of unemployment, a lot of underemployment, a lot of drug addiction, it's not accurate to say it's been a disaster for that part of the population. In fact, it may be the first time people have been able to access health care. What will happen now? What will happen now? This kind of Medicaid expansion might go away, no?
Well, you know, we don't know what's going to happen today. We don't know even if it passes, if the House passes it today. We don't know what the Senate's going to do. I know in Kentucky, one of the things I'm encouraged about is our Governor Matt Bevin has been someone who's wanted to make Kentucky a leader in giving second chances. And so we've had a lot of criminal justice reform. He's taken off the felony question off of state job applications, been focused on things like improving our foster care system. So I'm encouraged, at least in Kentucky, some other states I don't know. But in Kentucky, I think addiction treatment's going to continue. And I think it's really kind of early now to know what's going to happen. But there is a concern that if there's a rollback of the Medicaid expansion, there will be less access to treatment in some states.
Preston Wood, you are a registered nurse case manager at the Keck Hospital at the University of Southern California. Talk about the kind of work you do and how important access to health care has been. Has it increased with the Affordable Care Act, and what are you or what are healthcare professionals facing should some of those expansions of healthcare be taken away? Where are things going?
First of all, the brutality of the way of this discussion being led by the Republicans is so shocking. Paul Ryan's statement that his dreams are coming true underscores the speaker's reference to the transfer of funds to the rich again, the huge tax breaks. What does it mean on day-to-day work providing health care in a city like Los Angeles, which has huge numbers of people who are on Medi-Cal, which is Medicaid? The effects are going to be disastrous. One thing that the expansion of Medicaid has done has created the opportunity to build community health care centers which can treat people on a regular basis for not just addiction, but for other disease processes such as diabetes, heart failure, other things. This will be, I think, going to be decimated if this thing passes, because they are going to, within a year, knock 14 million people off their health insurance, and then over the next few years, another 10 or 12 million. What happens is that, and I agree with what's been said about the limitations of the Affordable Care Act, I agree completely, as my union does, in single payer. That is the only solution, because unless you deal with the insurance companies, unless you dismantle them, you're never going to have a solution, and that was the failure of the Affordable Care Act, because they tried to make a deal with the insurance companies, assure them huge profits. They got some profits, but now they're happy again that this is going to be happening, the dismantling of Obamacare, because they can revert back to their old system. Anthem Blue Cross chief executive, CEO, salary is $85 billion a year. It's the highest paid CEO in the United States. What is going to be happening for us is that the fact of the matter is basic medicine, if people don't receive regular care, things get worse for them. They wait until they have to go to the emergency rooms. Our emergency rooms are already overflowing with people, but with the dismantling of Obamacare and the exchanges in California, of which there are millions of people involved, once again, you're going to have the crisis created of people unable to get care. There was a study done recently. I work in a hospital, a tertiary care hospital that does very high-level transplants and things like that. We have many Medi-Cal patients. County has people who are not insured at all, including immigrants and others, and they have thousands and thousands of them. They did a study of the progression of cancer among patients at County who came in late, whose treatment was delayed. The size of their tumors was so much larger and profoundly metastasizing than the ones who received early treatment at my hospital. So it's all based on whether or not a society can provide the care that's needed. If they really were serious about lowering expenses, we would go to single payer because it's been proven time and time and again that that works. But it's the underlying greed and the setup where the insurance companies are collaborating with the politicians and the big farm and others, not just for denial of care, lack of access, but for the pushing of drugs into communities, of dismantling all the things that are part of Obamacare that are so needed by many, many millions of people, and which it seems clear to me, maybe it's not true, it seems to me that it's going to be really, the opponents, the right-wing opponents of Obamacare talked about death panels and how there would be, committee set up to really outline goals of care, such as how do you deal with end-of-life situations. What these people are doing is really setting up a death system where people will get sick and die sooner and suffer because they do not have basic health care that they have a right to, whether they're immigrants or whoever they are, workers or whoever.
Margaret Flowers, a death system, in other words, not death panels, but a system that consigns people to an earlier death than necessary. One of the statistics that has been talked about recently a lot is that the American place among countries when we're looking at or registering life expectancy, it's dropping. I mean, this is quite something, quite shocking, given the fact that it's the, quote, richest country in the world. And the UN has reported that the biggest indicator of whether life expectancy goes up or goes down for a country, the biggest indicator is access to health care. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's common sense, right? If people have access to health care, they're more likely to be healthy and to have things caught early and have a good outcome. The United States is the only industrialized nation that has this for-profit, private insurance-based part of its system. And you heard from Tim, the part of the system that works under ACA is the Medicaid, is the public insurance. The private insurances have a bottom line of developing, creating profit for their investors, and they do that by raising premiums as high as they can, charging as much as they can out of pocket, and then denying and restricting care. There have been a number of studies looking at the U.S. compared to other industrialized nations. We have the highest number of preventable deaths. We've looked at the number of people that are uninsured and how many of them die from lack of access to care in the United States. For about every 1 million people who are uninsured, 1,000 people die each year for lack of access to care. So that's right now with 29 million people uninsured. That's almost 30,000 people a year that are dying in the U.S. unnecessarily. So when you talk about, death panels, we've always known as health professionals, and I'm sure that Preston can attest to this as well, that the real death panels are coming from the private insurance industry who deny necessary care and charge such high out-of-pocket costs that people have a health insurance and they can't even afford to use it. And then just quickly, there are areas in the United States, and we see this here in Baltimore where I live, in the upper-income neighborhoods, higher life expectancy, even a 20-year difference between neighborhoods in our city based on income. So in the U.S., you only have as much health care as you can afford instead of what you need.
That's Dr. Margaret Flowers. We're going to take a short break in a moment, but in about a minute. But I'm going to start, Tim Robinson, with you and then come back to you after our break. The people who are receiving Medicaid, and again, it's about a third of the state of Kentucky, I believe, is now on Medicaid. All the polls also show that people on Medicaid who are poorer are less likely to vote than those who are not on Medicaid. So even though you would think that this destruction of the existing system, as bad as it may be, might be a real disaster for the poor people, they don't really seem to me to have much of a voice. What do you think? And then we're going to go to break and we'll come back to you.
Well, there's been a lot of folks added to the Medicaid rolls because of what's happened with the coal industry in Central Appalachia. And we are now at a historic 25-year low on the number of coal miners that are mining coal in Central Appalachia. So that's been one of the big hits to us. And the reason there's more people on Medicaid, because a lot of folks lost their private health insurance when they lost their coal jobs. But, you know, there is concern. You know, the 5th Congressional District in Eastern Kentucky is one of the districts nationally that's going to be hit the hardest if there is a Medicaid rollback. And so it's definitely a concern here. For us in addiction treatment, what's a real big concern is that addiction treatment and mental health services, as the bill currently reads today, that essential benefit provision that was put in place by the Affordable Care Act has been removed. And so it won't, addiction treatment and mental health won't have to be covered by insurance plans moving forward if it passes the House today. Again, I'm a person that's taking a wait and see approach. I think we've got, it's yet to be seen what's going to happen today. How is this going to go through the Senate? When you get to the Senate, you got several folks on both sides of the aisle that have an interest in taking a hard look at what is this going to do to different states like Kentucky, rural states, poor regions. And I think that we're definitely, there definitely needs to be some changes. Don't know if we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Okay, that's the voice of Tim Anderson. We're talking about the vote today in Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare and replace it with a new Republican plan called America Health Care Act. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the vote today in Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare and replace it with a Republican plan, the American Health Care Act. The Congressional Budget Organization reports that as many as 24 million people may lose health insurance. We're talking with Dr. Margaret Flowers from Baltimore, Maryland. She is a co-director of Popular Resistance. She's a pediatrician and an advocate of a single-payer healthcare system. We're also joined from Los Angeles by Preston Wood. He is a registered nurse case manager at USC Keck Hospital and a member of the California Nurses Association. And from Kentucky, from Eastern Kentucky, we're joined by Tim Robinson. He is the CEO of Addiction Recovery Care in Kentucky. Tim Robinson, before we went to the break, you talked about the fact that the addiction and mental health benefit that exists under the Affordable Health Care Act. Right now, if all things go as they seem to be going, if, in other words, the Senate and the Congress and Trump signed into law that which is pending before Congress, those benefits would disappear. Now, I'm just trying to understand that, and I want you to help understand, because you're right there. You're sort of at ground zero in terms of the crisis facing families. Families who are living in poverty, unemployment, underemployment. As you said, many people are on Medicaid now because the coal mines have been shutting down. And those workers have been sort of thrown on the heap there. There's nobody taking care of them. They have to fend for themselves after working perhaps for decades in the mines and then having lots of health problems when they're 45, 50, 55 years old, no employment. The pharmaceutical companies are pumping opioid drugs into West Virginia and into Kentucky and to other states in unbelievable numbers. I mean, they're really drug pushers. And so you have the problem of mass addiction. Why would this bill in Congress, why would these politicians not realize that this is dooming a big part of the population in Kentucky and other places to a life of absolute misery? Why are they doing this?
Well, you know, again, we don't know what's going to happen today. We don't know what's going to happen with the bill in the Senate. Some of these policy decisions are going to be sorted out on the state level. In Kentucky, our Governor Matt Bevin is a strong supporter of second chances and is trying to make Kentucky a leader in giving folks second chances. There's one side of this on the Medicaid side of some folks could lose coverage if the current version goes through. There'll be people lose coverage, especially in poor areas like Central Appalachia. At the same time, we've got to be focused on creating jobs and bringing jobs into areas like Central Appalachia and not settle just for a continual dependency culture and getting people back to work. Now, in order for those folks to go back to work, to get them back employed, there's going to have to be addiction treatment. I don't think anybody out there, wherever, if they're in an urban area, or rural area, Central Appalachia or L.A., would say that that we're going to be able to overcome the addiction issue without treatment. Treatment's got to be a major part of that solution. It's got to be, addiction's got to be treated as a disease. And if you're going to treat addiction as a disease, it's got to be a part of our healthcare system, which means it's got to be an essential benefit. And so that's something I think as policymakers, as Congress looks at this, that is one provision when it comes to the drug crisis. We've got to keep that as an essential benefit.
All right. We want to thank you. That was Tim Robinson. He is the CEO of Addiction Recovery Care in Kentucky. Tim Robinson, thank you for joining us, and we'll be back to you after we see how the House and the Senate vote and what actually happens with the law. We hope you'll be back. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Preston Wood, again, addiction and mental health benefit eliminated from the bill. Now, the United States, not just Kentucky, not just West Virginia, not just Ohio, but all over the United States, there are drug addiction problems, there are drug problems, there are alcohol problems, there is the problem of mass incarceration because in many ways, the prison population in the United States, 2.3 million people in prison, 7 million people in total on probation and parole, 25% of all of the prisoners in the country, in the world, are here in the United States. I mean, a lot of that is related to drugs, to alcohol, to mental health issues. I mean, how could it be that politicians who have very, very good health care benefits make it a priority to eliminate this kind of a benefit for the rest of the population?
Yes. And, you know, I would also add to that, Brian, the issue of nutrition. So many children now in the United States are malnourished. And nutrition and mental illness and mental health, addiction, these are all medical problems that require treatment. And there are dedicated clinicians everywhere who would want to create programs and expand programs in order to address this, because it is central to the problems that we're facing as working people, normal people in the United States. Mental health programs have been devastated ever since. They've always been completed on the back burner, but they've become less and less funded and less incorporated into the programs of major hospitals and community hospitals. And it's led to a crisis in this country. There are, as you say, there are just millions of people in the United States, a disproportionate number who are in prison for crimes related to addiction and mental illness. And their issues are not being addressed. So what you have is a system that is just like taking money out of the pockets of normal people, putting it in their own pockets, and just turning their backs, or actually shutting the door to any hope of a decent life to millions of people who could be leading productive and healthy life if the services would be provided. It takes resources and it takes money to do this, and the ruling elite in this country have made a decision, it seems to me, that there's a huge part of the population that they care nothing about, and they will do nothing for. So they're left to they're left on their own to deal, and that's why you have legions of homeless people in Los Angeles and other cities all across the country who have no other alternatives but to try to live day to day. The denial of health care, comprehensive health care, holistic health care, preventative care, are crucial for a society. It's a benchmark of where a society stands in the world and in its own history. And it's a sad realization, if you look at what is going on with the rulers of this country now, slamming the door on this and bragging about it, literally expressing no compassion, even fake compassion.
Dr. Flowers, let me ask you, you're a pediatrician. You are a doctor for children and babies. Here's a statement that came out a year ago, almost to this date, from the American Academy of Pediatrics. It says, and this is how it opens, almost half of young children in the United States live in poverty or near poverty. The American Academy of Pediatrics is committed to reducing and ultimately eliminating child poverty in the United States. Poverty and related social determinants of health can lead to adverse health outcomes in childhood and across the life course. Talk about how Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act impacted, either improved or otherwise, the healthcare delivery for children, what the main problems were and what the advances were under the Affordable Care Act, and what the new Republican plan will mean for healthcare services for kids.
Sure. Thank you, Brian. So the United States, under its CHIP program, or Children's Health Insurance Program, which is a public insurance, has done a pretty good job of trying to make sure that children have, especially particularly low-income children, have access to health care. But what the so-called Affordable Care Act did was it expanded Medicaid to adults. And we know that children do better when their parents are also healthy and able to take care of them and to work and do those things. So that was a benefit to children. Under the American Health Care Act, we expect, because of the cuts to Medicaid, that this is also going to mean cuts to these important programs for children, and also for children who are not in the public insurance programs, whose parents have private health insurance. They'll continue to see restrictions of benefits, restrictions of where people can go for care, and high out-of-pocket costs that keep families from seeking care early when they need to do that. But, you know, the issue of poverty, you know, is one that is so critical in these social determinants of health, such as access to education, healthy food, clean water, clean air, other things that have a huge impact on our health. You know, it's all connected, because when you look at countries that have national health programs or single-payer healthcare type of systems, because the nation is responsible for making sure that, you know, paying for people's health, it also impacts the rest of their public policy. So you don't see in countries in Europe, you know, they ban GMOs, they have higher standards of what types of chemicals can go into consumer products, and they understand that that has a health benefit to everyone. We don't have that here in the United States. We have quite the opposite. And then just one other quick point is that another way that the United States differs is that we depend on welfare programs like Medicaid, which are systems for the poor, and they tend to be poor systems. Other countries recognize that that's the outcome when you use a welfare type of program, and instead they adopt universal programs where every single person is in the same system, because that drives up the quality of that system.
All right. We're going to be joined now also by Jason Bailey. He's the executive director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. Welcome to the conversation, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jason. We were just talking with Tim Robinson. He's the CEO of something called the Addiction Recovery Care in Kentucky. He's in Eastern Kentucky. You're in Kentucky. Trump was just there. What we were talking with Tim about is the dichotomy between what Trump's announcement, his rhetoric that Obamacare has been a disaster for people in Kentucky, and yet a third of the people in Kentucky rely on Medicaid, and Medicaid was vastly expanded because of the Affordable Care Act. In spite of all of its other problems, that was something that was an advance. When you hear Trump talk about it being a disaster, and you think about the people who are now actually accessing health care because of Medicaid and expansion in Kentucky, what's your reaction as somebody who lives in Kentucky? And what is it possible to organize those people, the poor, who generally speaking don't vote as much, into some sort of political force that would at least stand up for a basic benefit that they have now achieved that's about to be taken away?
Well, I think it's possible, and you know, the reality is it hasn't been tried. I mean, the misinformation about the Affordable Care Act didn't start with Trump. You know, it's been going on for ever since the law was passed in this state, and a lot of misinformation, a lot of confusion, and even on the part of Democrats who, for example, the former Democratic governor who implemented the Medicaid expansion, they changed the name of the law to something different and really intentionally disassociated it from the president because the president was unpopular and sort of took a short-term view in that ended up leading to, just a disconnection between the fact that people got a lot of health care coverage they didn't have before and the fact and this law. That is, you know, if you poll the polls that have been done about Obamacare in Kentucky, it doesn't have very much support at all. But if you poll what's called Connect, which is the same thing, it is the Affordable Care Act in Kentucky, it has very high approval ratings. So a lot of confusion, and both parties contributed to that confusion. So I think that, you know, I think that there's a situation now where you have a law or a bill in front of Congress that would not only roll back that law, but permanently change the Medicaid program for other people that didn't, you know, that had coverage before, kids, seniors, people with disabilities. And if that law were to pass or something like it, you know, the repercussions in this state would be larger than anywhere. And so I think that the conversation is starting to change, and I think people are starting to understand what's at stake. So I think it will play out politically a lot different in the future than it has in the past.
Jason, I want to ask you a follow-up question since you just joined the conversation. We live in economic and social order, capitalism, that has made healthcare a commodity. It's made a lot of other things, matter of fact, almost everything a commodity, including pharmaceutical goods. There are two counties in West Virginia, which along with your state has the highest rate of opioid addiction, who have filed lawsuits against some of the major pharmaceutical manufacturers and some of the distributors. So they're suing McKesson, for instance, the fifth largest corporation in the United States, whose CEO made $85 million last year. Because these pharmaceutical companies are, they say, deliberately pouring opioid drugs into their counties. Between 2007 and 2012, according to the Washington Post, which was looking at their legal filings, drug distribution companies, these pharmaceuticals, shipped 780 million doses of opioids to West Virginia and 1,728 overdose deaths occurred. In other words, they're accusing the companies of being capitalist drug pushers of the first order. Is it possible, is it necessary that the pharmaceuticals and that the big sort of health equipment manufacturers, as well as the insurance companies, either be nationalized or just done away with, reorganized completely? In other words, make them something that's not commodity producers, but healthcare providers. We have 30 seconds, and then I'm going to come back to you and let you take another stab at it after the break. Go ahead.
I think that's what the Affordable Care Act didn't address, is sort of the extent to which the profit motive and the power of certain healthcare industries, the pharmaceutical being perhaps the most prominent, is the reason we have the most expensive healthcare in the world. And yet, before the Affordable Care Act was passed, 50 million people were uninsured. And so I think that is yet to be addressed. And it's something we have to address, both for the social reason that you identify specifically with opioid addiction, but also to rein in the cost of healthcare, you know, so that it doesn't eat up our entire economy. And we move more towards a system that actually improves people's health long term, does more for preventive care and wellness, and has a distribution of economic benefits that's fair, a lot fairer than what we see today.
All right. That is Jason Bailey. He's the executive director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. We're also talking to Dr. Margaret Flowers and Preston Wood. We're going to continue this discussion. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm joined by Margaret Flowers. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a pediatrician from Baltimore, Maryland. She's the co-director of Popular Resistance and an advocate for the single-payer health system. We're talking about the new Republican plan that will be voted on perhaps today. We're also joined from Los Angeles by Preston Wood. He is a registered nurse case manager at the USC Keck Hospital, and we are joined from Kentucky by Jason Bailey, Executive Director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. Preston Wood, talk about the people you're serving, and I want to ask you about it in light of the announced Trump budget reductions, which in many ways constitute what I would consider to be a looting of the national treasury and a redistribution, if it was possible to even redistribute it more from the bottom to the top. In other words, Robin Hood in reverse. One of the budget stipulations, and of course they're paying for a $54 billion increase in the so-called defense budget, the war budget, but one of the budget items is a $6 billion cut, almost 20% cut in the budget of the National Institutes of Health. I mean, money for weapons, money for war, and a $6 billion cut in the National Institutes of Health. I mean, will that have an impact on healthcare delivery, on research and development? Talk about that if you would.
Yes, thank you. In my job as a case manager, I deal directly every day with the healthcare system. I have to struggle to figure out how I can get resources for people when they leave the hospital. People who don't have adequate housing, people who don't have families that have been decimated, people who are undocumented, people who have mental health issues, who need things such as wheelchairs. They sound so simple. Other things, Hoyer lifts, other equipment. They need their medications sometimes, which cost thousands of dollars a month just to have. So this is like a strangulation by the capitalists, by the big corporations, including McKesson and the insurance companies and all the pharmaceuticals, strangulating the ability to get the resources that people need, whether they're on Medicare, where restrictions are increasing all the time, or private insurance, where you have to go through the most elaborate procedures just to get something authorized for a patient to get it, to get them transport if they don't have a way to get home, if they've come in from rural areas to a big city hospital because they need to, and they have no way to get back to their families. These are the things that are all part of the system. And the more they cut the funding for medical care, the more they restrict access to housing, the more they require this or that to obtain this or that medication or treatment, the more they deny, in other words, people's rights to stuff, the harder it gets for teams here in the hospital, dedicated doctors, nurses, case managers, all the staff who are struggling to provide the best possible care. You can just feel it coming down on you all the time, trying to get the resources. In any sane society or in a single-payer society, authorization for these things would be automatic, and case managers and nurses and doctors could spend all of their time creating the best plan for the patients, not the plan that's curtailed by barriers to care imposed by the insurance companies and by the prices that the pharmaceuticals and the equipment companies charge. So, yeah, there's a shrinking pool that we have to go to, and this is what's the process that's happening. That's why we need to be thinking about how we can link all these issues together in order to improve the lives of regular people, from housing to all the different issues, education, all the things that people need so badly. So healthcare is very much the center of it, and the points the speakers have been making about that, it sort of shows where society's at, when the health care is cut, it shows you that they have it has severe contradictions and problems going on. And the problem going on here is in the profit system.
It is the profit system, Dr. Flowers, because we have pharmaceuticals who get, you know, exclusive patents for 17 years or then new patents for already produced drugs that are now, you know, given new indications and new usage. And they're making money hand over fist. And it's, I mean, it's just outrageous that medicine here costs so much. And at the same time, I want to go back because I'm really shocked by these lawsuits in these two counties in West Virginia against these pharmaceuticals. It's obvious that they're engaged in what I believe to be criminal conduct. Again, the county, Cabell County, in the heart of West Virginia, was flooded with 40 million tablets of painkillers in a very short time with a population of 96,000 people. That's more than 400 pills for every adult and child. The distributors, the pharmaceuticals, according to the lawsuit, sent 66 million doses of oxycodone and hydrocodone into Kanawha County, population 190,000. And then addictions and deaths skyrocket. When you look at these kind of numbers, can't you make the case that these are criminal enterprises, that they should be seized, that they should be thus then nationalized? And instead of using this as a source of mega profits, that pharmaceuticals be produced to actually provide medicine to help people get better?
We have profit as the bottom line of our system and not health. And so you see this in the pharmaceutical industry. And I totally agree that we could argue that much of what they're doing is criminal, because it's all about exploiting people and making profits. Same thing happens in the private health insurance industry. You know, they basically do whatever they can to deny and restrict care and charge as much as they can, shift as much of the cost to the individual as they can so that they can make profits. And if you look at the major health insurance companies in the U.S. and you look at their stock values over the last 5 or 6 years, you'll see that they're growing quite well. And that's because they wrote the Affordable Care Act to benefit themselves, and then the American Health Care Act is just going to make that worse. I wanted to quickly comment on the NIH cuts, because what that's going to do is going to drive, you know, as public funding dries up for pharmaceutical research, you're going to see more of the private corporations taking on that research. And again, their interest is not in improving our overall public health. Their interest is in finding the fastest and easiest way to make a new medicine and market it to people, convince them that they need it and sell it. That's all that they're about. So this is a real negative direction that we're going in with that. We should be increasing the funding for pharmaceutical research at the public level and keeping it in the public. Physicians for National Health Program, of which I'm a member, also, in addition to having a national proposal for a Medicare for All healthcare system, has a national proposal now for nationalizing pharmaceuticals as well, so that health is the bottom line. And I just urge people that no matter what happens today in the House, well, if it passes in the House and goes to the Senate, we're trying to pressure Senator Sanders to introduce a substitution amendment in the Senate that would substitute a single-payer or Medicare for All system for the American Health Care Act. He's done that before, and we hope that people will pressure him to do that again.
I want to ask you, Jason Bailey, about the impact of the elimination of tax credits, because the American Health Care Act replaces the Obamacare or Affordable Health Care Act subsidies with tax credits. But they amount to a major reduction in assistance. But by eliminating the taxes associated with the Affordable Care Act, those making over $250,000 a year stand to save altogether about $27 billion a year. In addition, the American Health Care Act, the Republican bill, repeals the ACA provision prohibiting corporations from writing off the salaries of employees who make more than $500,000 a year. Of course, the question is the American Health Care Act a big tax giveaway to the rich and to the corporations? Jason, you wrote earlier this week, cutting those taxes would benefit only 1.4% of Kentuckians, according to an analysis by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. That's less than half of 3% of Americans who would receive tax cuts. Of all the states, only West Virginia has a smaller share of the population getting tax cuts at 1.2%. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, I think the law is essentially a massive shift to give tax cuts to the people at the very top, to the millionaires, who largely don't live in Kentucky. I mean, we have some millionaires, but as you just noted, less than half of the share of the national average of people collecting tax cuts under this plan live in Kentucky. It's a massive shift to those people from the moderate and low-income people who got covered under mostly the Medicaid expansion, but other parts of the Affordable Care Act. So this is a tax cut, first and foremost. It's a massive redistribution of wealth from everyday people to those at the top. And it's states like Kentucky and West Virginia, as you mentioned, that are getting the rawest end of this deal, because we are states that expanded Medicaid under the law. And so we got covered. We have low income, so we had lots and lots of people eligible, much more than was anticipated or projected, got covered under the law. Under this proposal, all that would be taken away to give huge tax cuts to not only the wealthy, but also corporate insurance companies and other healthcare corporations.
Preston Wood, the American Health Care Act, the Republican bill, suspends federal funding for Planned Parenthood for 1 year. The Trump administration insultingly tried to cut a deal with Planned Parenthood in which Planned Parenthood would, quote, stop providing abortions in return for a restoration of funding. But they held strong. They turned that down. Planned Parenthood Executive Vice President Don Laugan said, offering money to Planned Parenthood to abandon our patients and our values is not a deal that we will ever accept. Providing critical health care services for millions of American women is non-negotiable. Talk to the larger audience, because we have a U.S. and global audience, about this latest attack on Planned Parenthood. Why that? What's going on?
Continuation of a large campaign to deny the rights to full health care, control of your own bodies to women. It is a sexist and shocking undermining of women's rights, going after Planned Parenthood, trying to demonize Planned Parenthood, which is so incredible since they do so much for women and families across the country, is another expanding part of the agenda of the right wing to demonize and divide and to attack the unity that's building among men and women, transgendered people, all people, against this monstrous right-wing dismantling of all so many programs that we fought for. So I think we all have to really commend Planned Parenthood for standing up that way and speaking so clearly that they're not giving up their programs to help women. The attack on abortion rights is an attack on women, and they understand that. And by going ahead and saying they will continue, even if their funding is cut, is a very strong sentiment. It requires, you know, the solidarity of everyone who's concerned about health care, not just for women, but for everyone.
Margaret Flowers, same question to you. I mean, Roe v. Wade was made into law in 1973 by the Supreme Court. That was, of course, during the Nixon era. Nixon was a conservative, a right winger, but masses of women and people who cared about women's rights were in the streets demanding this fundamental right for women to control their own bodies and to end the scourge of women either being badly injured or dying as a consequence of having unsafe, illegal abortions. What do you think is coming? Now we have a right-wing Supreme Court, which we've had, but it will be Neil Gorsuch is perhaps even to the right of Scalia. I think he is to the right of Scalia. If he's confirmed, you have a right-wing president, you have a right-wing Congress, you have a right-wing Senate, you have in many states abortion rights already out of the picture because of all these obstructions enacted by state and local governments. Obviously, Congress and the political process is not what's going to save abortion rights. I mean, something has to be done. There has to be the revival of that kind of women's movement or mass movement that made Roe v. Wade possible. I mean, this is a big deal in America right now, especially for women and girls. Go ahead.
Well, it is a huge deal. And you know, I'm old enough to remember that, you know, the time when before abortions were legal and how many women were suffering and dying, because people don't stop getting abortions just because they've been made illegal. They just go underground to get them where it's not safe. And Planned Parenthood does so much more than just providing abortions. They provide basic reproductive care and primary care to women. And so, you know, they're really essential, particularly in our health system that is so under-resourced, especially for people of lower income. So this is critical. But when you get to the movement part, yes, that's absolutely essential. That's why we created popularresistance.org. All of the things that we need, strong public education, you know, better jobs, living wages, clean environment, healthcare, all of these things we're going to have to fight against because our political system is a plutocracy. It benefits the wealthy. That's been documented now by academic studies over the last few decades. So it's not something that just arose. It's just continuing to get worse. And so the sooner that we organize in our communities and fight back against these policies and promote positive alternatives like healthcare for all, like strong public education, the sooner we're going to win these struggles.
Jason Bailey, Donald Trump says he wants to get this over with because he wants to get on to his real agenda, which is cutting taxes for the rich, cutting taxes for the corporations, cutting all regulations, all protections for the environment. In other words, Trump really doesn't give a damn about this. It's just he has to get through it because the mantra of the Republicans was Obamacare must go. That's what's really coming, right? Try to characterize, if you would. We have about 90 seconds left, so you get the last word. Try to characterize as best you could what the Trump government, what the Trump administration's real agenda is here and going forward.
I think you're right that tax cuts are the prize, and what they, and certainly what Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell want, and is really what the, in addition to the healthcare repeal being a promise to the base, it's also, as we mentioned earlier, a massive tax cut. So they want to do this tax cut first, so they can make room for the next tax cut, in addition to deregulating Wall Street and gutting the EPA and other things. So I think that, you know, you have an agenda that is very part of the reason that you see Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell sticking with Trump, the president, even with all the doubts and information about investigation around espionage, et cetera, is because they see an opportunity to get what they've wanted for a very long time, which is to shrink the foundations that were created through, you know, the New Deal and the Great Society, and give that back to the wealthy and powerful corporations in large, unprecedentedly large tax cuts. So that's what we're dealing with in this year, and unprecedentedly radical changes are on the agenda. And it's an important time for everyone to be aware of those and know who the winners are, which is a very small group of already powerful and wealthy people, and who the losers are, which is the rest of the American public.
I agree with you. A government that has as its goal the imposition of capitalism without restraint for the benefit of the very, very, very top. We've been joined by Jason Bailey. He's the executive director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. Dr. Margaret Flower, she's the co-director of Popular Resistance. And Preston Wood, he is a registered nurse case manager at the University of Southern California Keck Hospital and a member of the California Nurses Association. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.